Melissa Hildes is an innovator, and she is a champion for doing more good in the Salesforce ecosystem. And that is embodied through her work with the nonprofits that she works with and the community that she serves so gracefully and dutifully. And it has been amazing to have her on this episode of the DevOps Diaries podcast. We jump into all things data cloud and how data is going to shape how we as consumers interact with companies, how nonprofits can get the most out of their businesses and most out of the people working from them. And of course, we touch on AI and the implications that that has on humans and us as people. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Melissa Hildes is a light in the Salesforce ecosystem and also a bookworm. So if you're a bookie too, then you'll get plenty of book recommendations by listening to the full episode. I hope you enjoy. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the DevOps Diaries podcast. And I'm very, very pleased to be joined by one of my great friends in the Salesforce space, Melissa Hildes. Melissa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. And I tell you what, it's been too long coming.
I know that time zones and time constraints get in the way sometime, right?
They always do. They always do. But I'm very, very glad to have you on the podcast and sharing your knowledge with the listeners. Very pleased indeed. And for the listeners, Melissa, can you tell me, or tell the listeners even, a little bit about your experience and the lens that you view the world through, Salesforce ecosystem or otherwise, that will help them understand how you look at things and where you come from?
Sure. So ironically, I started in computer science. You know, I don't even know if we still call it that anymore. A long, long, long time ago, back about the same time that, Bill Gates was getting into computer science, and realized very quickly that I was not going to be a programmer, that that's not who I was, not what I wanted to do when I grew up. And nobody, which I try, that's one of the reasons I really work hard to let people know there are other ways to be involved in technology besides being a developer, right? Nobody at that time told me that I could sell software or I could be a business analyst or I could do all these other different things that are involved in technology. So I dropped out of college and, you know, made tons of money in a very successful sales career in corporate America. And at the ripe old age of about 37, I married and had a baby and stayed home for a while and had no idea what to do with myself. And got involved with nonprofits and was the executive director for Habitat for Humanity here locally, worked with volunteers, worked with the United Way, and realized that we kept trying to do the same. We do the same thing over and over again and trying to get different results, you know, and I've always been told that was insanity. So I decided that I needed to go back to school, finish my degree, because I really wanted the credentials to back me up for being able to help nonprofits innovate, think about things differently, do something different so that we could do more good. You know, that's the hashtag I always use. And so I did, I finished a degree. I said, whatever was quickest for me to finish, it turned out to be management of technology. And by that time I had gotten into the Salesforce ecosystem, was working with Hands-On Connect and ISV. And I thought, oh, perfect. Now I have the opportunity. I've got this degree finished and I can do all these certifications with Salesforce, which I now have 11, I think, and help nonprofits. And then I had an opportunity to do an MBA. I got a scholarship to do an MBA and did that in digital entrepreneurship. So I was excited to do that and learned so much. And still my goal, when I do my V2 mom every year, my goal is really to increase the impact that nonprofits are having, you know, work themselves out of a job and leverage technology to do that. So that really is always the lens that I look through. How do we make it easy? How do we make it simple? How do we automate what can be automated so that humans have time to do the things that only humans can do, you know? And that's where my motivations come from, my goals, and the reason I get up every morning.
That's lovely. And that hashtag do more good is something that I've seen you embody personally time and time and time again. And I feel that's one trait of the Salesforce nonprofit community, especially, is everybody's so dedicated to the nonprofits that they work for, but also nonprofit generally. and advocating for nonprofits. What do you think makes nonprofits special, and what do you think really is the secret to becoming a successful nonprofit in the technology space and utilizing technology?
That's a great question, Jack, because there are really great things that make nonprofits different. I have a presentation that I do talking about 501c3 is not a business model, and it's not. You know, it's a tax designation in the U.S. so that you don't have to pay corporate taxes, but it's not a business model. On the other hand, I think that there is a lot of confusion around that, around being innovative, a lot of fear of change. You know, what if we do something different and we can't feed as many children this year? You know, so if you're an entrepreneur and you're in a for-profit business, risk aversion is not something, you know, you want. You want people who are not risk averse, who are willing to try something, and if it fails, okay, it's just money, right? Mm. But in the nonprofit world, I think that there is the feeling of, if we try this and it fails, then we are going to fail at our mission, and our mission impacts humans, right? You know, we could live, you could live without a new cell phone, right? You can't live without food. And childhood hunger is, you know, especially close to my heart. So I think for nonprofits in particular, there's a lot of education that we need to do. Dan Pelota, if you've seen his TED talk, that's probably 10 years old now, but he talks about paying nonprofit executives what you would pay a for-profit executive, because you want the best and the brightest, right? And if you can make 10 times in the for-profit world what you can at a nonprofit, then is it a better return on investment to go work for the for-profit and donate money? You know, so there's a lot of a thought process in the way that I think that we can try and change. But you're right. I think the key thing that makes nonprofits really spectacular is the dedication by the employees that work there. In fact, so much so that the turnover rate for employees at nonprofits is really high, because generally you're making a lower salary. What you do every day is so critical. I think the burnout rate is probably higher, and I think that's what happens. Right.
Yeah.
So, because they are so dedicated, and that can become a stumbling block.
It's a double-edged sword, really, you know? Absolutely. And something you mentioned twice already, or two things that you mentioned that are synonymous, I guess, and important for this conversation that we're having, is you've mentioned doing the same thing over again and expecting different results is insanity. It's a common phrase. I think a lot of us will be familiar with that phrase. And you've mentioned innovation. How do you bring the two together in nonprofit and or anywhere really? This doesn't even apply to nonprofit. I think we see it in corporate world too, or we see it even in Salesforce. We do the same things, or there is a risk that consultants or system integrators do the same things, expecting different results at different clients. And how do we bridge that gap? How do we innovate more on the platform, and what's the pathway? What kind of pathway do you see for us to do that more?
Yeah, and I think there are a couple of key things. I think one is really in the user experience, right? AI is a good example. Everybody, you know, for years, I mean, we all thought, AI is going to take over the world, you know, all the science fiction horror films and that we grew up with, right? And Big Brother's watching. I mean, I don't know if anybody, you know, younger than I am actually read 1984, but, you know, before it was 1984, some of you weren't born. But then ChatGPT, to call them out specifically, you know, what, a year and a half ago, came out with a user interface that was so easy that anybody could use. There was no thinking about it. There was no training. There was nothing to block people from trying to do that, right? It didn't even cost anything, right? You could just do it. And I don't know. I'm trying to think of anybody that I know that hasn't done something in that arena. You know, I mean, at least had them rewrite a letter or a paragraph or something. right? To me, that user interface is probably the single most important thing, right? Because innovating, if there's no user acceptance, then it's not really innovation. I've told our developers that, you know, it's like, you may be absolutely brilliant and write the most phenomenal, you know, application ever, but if nobody ever uses it, does it really matter? You know? So I think that is something we need to remember, because I really started thinking about, you know, why all of a sudden it's like ChatGPT just came out full blown, you know, mm-hmm. and they didn't really, right? And I'm sure you've kept up and you've seen how much has improved and changed, and now they have a tier, you know, and you can pay for a certain tier and da 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 da. But they got that initial acceptance because it was so easy to use, mm-hmm. right? If you had had to go to a half day class to learn how to use it, I mean, who's got time, right? Mm-hmm. Or motivation or energy. So I think that's really important. I think the other thing is, in fact, when I was doing my MBA, John Steinberg, who was the founder of Cheddar, one of the things that he said that I'll never forget was that in one of our classes, he was helping teach, and he said that people don't want a vitamin, they want a pain pill, right? So I think that's another critical piece of innovation. You know, you and I probably think about innovations that are going to be vitamins, that are going to make things, you know, make you feel better, make you stronger, make you faster. But most people aren't really willing to do anything until it hurts so badly that they've got to do something. Mm-hmm. The analogy I would give you is my husband, Mitch, who needs a knee replacement, you know, and he's kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off and putting it off until now it hurts badly enough that he's finally scheduling it. Right. So yeah. People are not very proactive. I think they're more reactive. So those of us who are less risk averse, who can innovate on their behalf, you know the causes and the things that they're trying to accomplish and innovate on their behalf and hand it to them in such a way that they don't even have to think about it. They just use it. I think that's an important factor in really pushing innovation forward.
Yeah. It's interesting. You mentioned if you had to take a half-day course to learn how to use something like ChatGPT, there'd be less people using it, or there'd be less acceptance of the technology in mm-hmm. general, which I get, and I understand that, and I agree with you to a large extent. I think ChatGPT and those technologies, you know, Einstein Copilot Studio and Salesforce, all of these things do have a super low barrier to entry.
Right.
But what do you think that does across I guess all of humanity, I guess, but users in general and the people who look at these tools and say, okay, you don't need a course or you don't need a degree to understand it. So let's take an example, right? A lawyer goes away and does a law degree, has to pass the bar, etc. They're a lawyer. You know, you go to a lawyer, you expect certain results out of them, they're trusted and what have you. Technology like ChatGPT and Copilot Studio, etc., that barrier to entry is so low. Does that mean that we risk devaluing the amount of skill that it will take to actually use it effectively?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why I think this. Again, you'll see I'm an avid reader. I read a lot. And there was a great book that's an older book called, I have to think of the name of it. I can't think of it right now, but I read it during my MBA. And he talked about, and this was before ChatGPT, right? So this was 3 years ago, probably. And he was talking about what if, from the AI standpoint, a doctor, you know, your doctor that you see, you know, every 6 months or however often you have to go every year for your physical, could access all the data that's available, like for your symptoms, right?
Yeah.
And I think we've had this conversation, Jack, about the fact that I'm redheaded, right? So there's been research done on redheads that indicate that redheads need more anesthesia than other people to be knocked out, right? And to stay knocked out, which to me is an important thing. If I'm going to have surgery, I want my anesthesiologist to know that. I don't want to wake up.
Yeah, you don't want to wake up on the table.
But I have had exactly one doctor in all my experience who had actually heard of that study and knew about that. The only reason they knew afterwards was because I told them, right? So I think it's important. It's that there's always going to have to be people in the loop, right? To do the things that AI can't do, right? I mean, it doesn't matter how, I mean, and I don't know about you. And when I was pregnant with my daughter and internet was a thing, and because I was older and more concerned, you know, everything, if I sneezed or whatever, I would, you know, oh my goodness, what, you know, the baby. And my OBGYN got really tickled at me because I was so cognizant and I could find so much information, which can be terrifying, right? Mm. But a doctor who is trained can take that information and then actually make a diagnosis for you, right? But having more information, he can't go to the library and sit down and, you know, go through all the medical books. And you can't expect one human to know all the medical research that's been done all across the world, right? But that's important. I mean, I want my doctor to know that. So having access to that, however it's done, and maybe in a curated way, I think you're right. I mean, I think there are different use cases and different things from trusted sources. You know, when I go on online and look for medical information, I go to Mayo Clinic or I go to the National Health Services, you know, in UK, or, you know, I don't just, you know, mom and pop don't like vaccines.
Don't go to WebMD.
Right. I don't know. Right. So I think that's the important thing in understanding the users. Right. So, and when I say you don't have to learn, go to a class for half a day, right? There's a difference in just a regular everyday user and someone who is actually going to be leveraging the data, updating the data, working with the data. Yes, that person, you know, if you're a developer, you're an architect, you're the Salesforce administrator, then yes, you probably do need a half day class, right? But the end user, and they're the ones that really drive things, even for nonprofits. So I shop online almost exclusively now because I just get too frustrated going to the stores and they don't have the color I want, or they don't have the size I want. But it's so easy. And I can tell you my favorite apps and the ones that I go back to again and again and again. And I need to be able to donate that easily. You know, so my favorite nonprofits need to make it that simple for me to make donations. They need to make it that simple for me to sign up to volunteer. You know, I'm still fighting with our local doctors and dentists about me being able to make appointments. You know, why can't I do that online? Why do I have to try and call when your office is open, which is like from 9 until noon and 1:30 to 4:30, you know, and make an appointment? Why can't I do that online? So the end user is where it's got to be super, super, super simple.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that interaction, I think that biggest frustration is always that, especially for folks that have grown up with the internet and are used to user experiences, which a large majority of our users in Salesforce will have done. They'll have computer experience and they want systems to be seamless. Like, how many times have this brings me quite nicely, because you mentioned data, and I want to get onto data cloud and your thoughts and opinions on data cloud. But the user experience in turn, and I've been in sales, so I know what this is like. And the number one question that a salesperson hears from anybody internally is from their VP, and is it, have you updated Salesforce? because they need that data to work off that data. And if Salesforce is a pain to use for a salesperson, Trust me, they're not going to do it, because I've been that person. Not in Salesforce, in our old CRM that we used to use once upon a time ago. It was just such, that user experience was such a pain, which means the data wasn't accurate and reflective of what was actually going on in the business, which does bring me into that next point about data cloud. and the importance of data cloud, and we've started to talk about AI, so let's carry on down that path too. Where do you see this going and that importance of data cleanliness, and especially in nonprofit world, you're talking about tracking donors and donations and all those things that are highly important for regulatory 501(c)(3) requirements. What's going to happen here?
I don't know. I tell you something I'm excited about.
Okay, what should happen?
Something I would like to see happen. So this is, you know, sometimes you get to the point of, if you can't beat them, join them, right? So one of the things, especially in the Salesforce ecosystem, Jack, and I really would be interested to know what you think about this. In the Salesforce ecosystem, you know, there are so many ISV partners, you know, people who create these wonderful apps that you can buy on the AppExchange, you know, install in your instance. There's training, there's support, there's all these great things. But again, it's change, right? So with Hands-On Connect, you know, which is a volunteer management application, as opposed to volunteer for Salesforce, which is a volunteer management application, you know, and volunteers for Salesforce is free, like a puppy's free, you know, then you got to take it to the vet and pay big bucks for an implementer to fix it. Or Hands-On Connect, which is not free, you pay for it, but you have the support, you have all that, but it's change, right? So even if they hate volunteers for Salesforce, changing to Hands-On Connect is hard. So with Data Cloud, if I understand it correctly, and I have to admit, I've already failed the data cloud consultant once. I'm scheduled to take it again. If I understand it correctly, one of the real benefits of data cloud is being able to bring external data easily, right, and economically into your Salesforce instance. So my thought for nonprofits in particular, if you absolutely love Volgistics. Maybe Volgistics is what you've used for volunteers for 100 years, and all your volunteers know how to use it, and they hate it, but they know how to use it, and you hate it, but you know how to use it. Rather than try and press change management on them, why not just bring that data into Salesforce via Data Cloud, right? And so you've got that 360-degree picture of the person in Salesforce, where the executives in your nonprofit, the development team in your nonprofit, the folks in your nonprofit that need to be able to make those decisions can do that. So I think that's a huge plus for nonprofits, to be able to not have to change, you know, what little, you know, Aunt Sally's been doing for the last 50 years, the way she's always done it, but to be able to capture that data in a more automated way and a more consistent way. And then, like you say, to get it all into Salesforce and tie it together, right? One of my biggest frustrations is I feel like I have a split personality sometimes. You know, I mean, you know how many email addresses I have, and every one of those email addresses is a different persona, is a different part of who I am. But in a system where I'm using all of those, I feel like the system ought to know that they're all me. You know, they're all Melissa Hill D's, no matter what comes after the at symbol, you know? And I think that's what everybody's really tried to do. I mean, don't you think that's true in the corporate world too?
I think yes. I think unification of data is important for customer experience. And Salesforce have been talking about this for a long time.
Yeah.
And you know, customer 360 was the go-to word that now hasn't been used. That was kind of the thing for maybe a couple of Dreamforces ago. Customer 360 was a thing, but that's no longer a thing. It's now AI data, CRM.
But I think customer 360 is more achievable now with data cloud and the unification and
absolutely. And I think the thing that ties all of it together, whether you are a for-profit or a non-profit, is that holistic view of the customer allows you to make better business decisions. And that is incredibly important in non-profits. More so, you know, I'm gonna stand on a bit of a soapbox here and say that the work that non-profit do is more beneficial than corporate for the example of this conversation. Because if we have a better view of the people that we're trying to serve as non-profits, my partner, she works for Black Girls Code at the moment, and having that unified view of the people that they're helping and the young girls that they are helping, is super important to see their success journey through their programs and because they were in those programs, and to be able to have a view of all our volunteers. So, you know, somebody that you impacted as a nonprofit may become a volunteer for you and then may become a huge donor for you later down the line, and having that visibility of a person's journey. You know, mm-hmm. I talk about people a lot, you talk about people a lot, and people are so important. And the better we understand people, the better we can make decisions about them. You know, I think it's great that Data Cloud is here, and I think AI being able to consolidate that data and allow, give us the information that we need back to make decisions is going to be hugely important for us to make the right decisions. And I think generally all of this data that has previously been in disparate systems, I've been there, you've been there, you know, you've got 70 different spreadsheets and a CRM and God knows what else. To have that all in one place will hopefully improve decision-making from data-driven decision-making, which is this seems to be another corporate buzz thing at the moment, data-driven decisions. You need data for everything. And hopefully we can unify those things with these developments is what I'm hoping, and then what I'm hoping happens.
I hope so too with Data Cloud. And I think a couple of things that are maybe peculiar to nonprofits. One is nonprofits, you know, charities are notorious for collecting vast amounts of data. I mean, just ginormous amounts of data. They want to know everything, you know, from your birthday to your firstborn child's name to, you know, just huge amounts of data. But in my experience working with nonprofits, most of them never do anything with it. And again, it's because somebody's got to figure out how to put it together in a way that makes it useful, right? And, you know, with free Tableau licenses for nonprofits, you know, that's such a great way to visualize all that unified data and, like you say, be able to make decisions. The other thing is the return on investment, right? So it's easy for a corporate company, you know, somebody who's in it for the money, to say, okay, well, Data Cloud is, you know, by what you consume, that's how you pay for it, right? It's not a flat fee, which is hard for nonprofits to budget. But for a corporate business, you're like, okay, fine. So we get more customers, we use more, you know, we consume more in Data Cloud, it pays for itself. The return on investment is there. And so coming up with a good way to help nonprofits understand their return on investment, because, you know, nonprofits can make money. It's not that they can't make money. That's where the misconception is. You can get as many donations, do as many things as you want to raise funds. It just has to be plowed back into the mission instead of, you know, to investors or to stakeholders. So you can, but seeing and making that correlation in executives' brains and in program managers' brains at nonprofits, how do we explain that return on investment to them for the automations that are done?
Yeah, does that, I guess my question to you then is, you mentioned about having the best corporate leaders and paying the best corporate leaders to come to nonprofits and making sure that they get results and return on investment, and being able to articulate return on investment. Number one question is, do you think nonprofits generally struggle to understand ROI of technology investment? And question number two is, because there is a pay-to-play aspect of Data Cloud or Einstein Copilot or what have you, you know, if there'll be, it'll be an additional license cost or whatever it is, is that barrier to entry prohibitive for nonprofit organizations, at least in this first instance, when they might be the people that need it most?
Yep. And I think you said it beautifully, Jack. I think it is going to be a challenge, and I think they are the ones who need it most, right? That in fact, that we could all most benefit from them having it. And that's something I have looked at trying to figure out, for example, and I go back to this because trying to sell the value of something that's completely intangible, right, to a nonprofit and something like a volunteer management application. And the only return on investment I could share at that point in time was to say, what would you pay a human to do this manually for you on an annual basis? Because, you know, what Hands-On Connect costs as a subscription on an annual basis is, I don't know, maybe 20% of what you would have to pay a human to do it manually, right? So to me, that seems like a good reason to automate it. Yay, nay. The same thing with text messaging, right? I mean, I have a 21-year-old daughter who doesn't call me on the phone. The only reason she ever calls me is if she needs money. Otherwise, there's texting. Right? I guess when she calls me, she's like, Mommy. You
know, like, yeah, she can add the tone into those messages.
Right. You know? But she texts me. My mother, who's 86 and has never worked in an office, never used a computer, text messages me right on the phone. So nonprofits, so many nonprofits don't use text messaging. And I'm like, why? You know, they're still email. Everything's email driven. I'm like, my 86-year-old mother doesn't even have an email address. My 21-year-old daughter has email addresses. She doesn't check any of them, you know. However, if you text my 21-year-old daughter or my 86-year-old mother, either one of them will answer a text message. So who are your audience? You know, who are you trying to reach?
Yeah, so that's a core like tenant of even I'm going to come back to my sales experience. You know, meet the customer where they are and what they're doing, right, is so important.
Yeah, 80% of consumers do everything on their cell phone. My mother doesn't own a computer. So if it's not on her cell phone, she's like, I don't know how to use a computer. I'm like, Mom, your iPhone's a computer. She's like, no, it's not.
I'm the same. I say a computer all day, every day. But if I can't do something that I need to do. So for example, I had to sort some of my local like tax stuff out like today. Yeah. And it frustrated me that I couldn't do it on my phone. Even though I was sitting at my, I'm not kidding. I was sitting at my desk in front of my computer with it switched on, and I was annoyed that I couldn't do it on my phone.
Right. And I think that's, like I say, it all goes back to that end user experience. I think that may be the selling point, you know, when I say selling in a, not in a, you know, give me money kind of way, but in encouraging change management, right? If nonprofits see that their donors, their volunteers, their advocates are so much happier with what they are experiencing on a mobile, right? To be able to go and not have to have three personas because I advocate for and I'm a donor and I'm, you know, I don't want to have three different logins to be able to, you know, help my favorite nonprofit. That's kind of crazy, right?
That's insane.
And that's what happens if you have three different systems, right?
Yeah. So absolutely. Something that I want to come back to that you mentioned right at the start of the conversation is you want to automate things to take that away from what humans are doing. So if humans can focus on what humans should be focusing on, what should humans be focusing on to you?
So, and I think you know the answer to that question. I think it's a loaded question, but I think that human interaction is what's so important, right? Humans shouldn't have to worry about running a report, putting it all together, doing it when they could spend the time to get to know the volunteers individually, to be able to help them better work through things. What would you be really happy doing as a volunteer, right? Instead of trying to make sure that they're placed, you know, in this hole or whatever. Those sorts of things that the one thing that AI is never going to be able to replace, as far as I can, not yet, not in, probably not in my lifetime, is a hug, you know? I mean, there, you know, you're a great hugger. Ben Bolipew is a great hugger. You know, there are just people that, you know, they care. And sometimes that, I don't always know what to say to people, but to reach out and just touch them, right? I sat next to someone at Amanda Beer Nielsen's memorial service, and she was obviously upset and in tears, and I really didn't know what to say, but I just put my arm around her. You know, those are the kinds of things that AI can't do, computers can't do, automation can't do, but that we as people need to have the time to do, right? And so not be tied to our desk nonstop all day long, every day. And I've done that. I've done that even working in nonprofits. You know, if I can just get this one more thing done. So that's exactly the kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that empathy and human connection is highly important. And I think we often forget that we embody a physical space. As humans, we get lost in digital spaces. And there's, and that I was actually having this conversation with one of my colleagues about AI chatbots, and that the chatbots are able to display degrees of empathy, and you know, which I find the responses that they were saying that were studied, and these chatbots were giving responses that were empathy driven, and you know, that were in keeping with what a human could potentially say, or maybe should potentially say. But I think what's so dangerous about that is that, you know, let's use your text messaging to a phone call conversation example from earlier. Somebody's having a bad time.
Mm-hmm.
A phone call or a video call with that person is going to be 1,000 times more effective and empathetic than engaging with them over a text message, just because it's human on the other side of the text message rather than an AI chatbot or what have you. It doesn't mean anything, because the method of delivery is the same. And then we as humans embody physical spaces, and think how much better you feel after having a conversation with somebody in person, and a cry and a hug, like you mentioned, or in those empathetic scenarios. And I think that's one of those things where we talk about business and decisions being made. If we have all this data, but we can bring all the people that we need in the room to have an actual human discussion and conversation about that data, and they haven't had to sit there, you know, like this world of remote work. And like I advocate for remote work. I only remote work for the majority of the time, even though my office is 15 miles away. I still go into the office once every couple of weeks or so, just for that human connection and to keep those things running. And that's why I love going to Salesforce community events, to continue to build on those connections that can be made so much quicker and so much easier. And the empathy and that humanness is there. I think that we forget a lot of the time, because we do sit behind a computer all day building the flow, or building, writing Apex code, lightning web components, tinkering with Copilot Studio, whatever it might be. We forget that we embody a physical space more than we embody a digital space. And I think you're right.
I agree. In fact, this book that I'm reading, the one I was telling you about, The Practical Artificial Intelligence, right? One of the things he said is, what AI cannot do by itself is be creative to empathize. It cannot create a strategy for you and cannot improvise on the fly, right? It really can. It can only, empathy, for example, AI can't empathize. It's not human. It can appear to, but that's not the same. And I just think that's so important. One of the organizations that I've worked with that is actually there in the UK that is doing incredible work is Food Cycle. And I don't know if you're familiar with them. I think they have a place in Cambridge, but what they provide is not only a meal, right? Food that volunteers put together, but they do it. It's not like Meals on Wheels where they go and deliver the food, but it's actually in a location. Anybody can come, regardless, you know, whether you're the lord of the manor or if you're homeless, it doesn't matter. Because the other part of their mission is to provide community, to provide, like you say, that physical space, right? So when COVID hit in 2020, they panicked because they couldn't do the meals, you know, and there were people who depended on being able to connect that way with others. And so we actually worked on a way. They didn't have anybody's names, phone numbers, nothing, because you don't have to register anything. And we worked with them to create what we call check-in and chat, right?
Yeah.
And so they started making phone calls to be able to continue that sense of belonging and community, and somebody cares about whether you exist or not, right? So they really adapted incredibly well. Now they are phasing out check-in and chat because, of course, they don't need it anymore with the biggest, worst part of COVID over. and everybody's back in the kitchen cooking together and folks are coming to eat. And it really is that sense of community that technology can't replace. We can help schedule and manage and project manage and do all those sorts of things, but coming together to break bread together is not something you can do digitally.
Yeah, I agree. It's something that I've been maybe wrestling with, or I would like to see particular companies do this. So I was sitting in at Trailblazer DX in a conversation between one of the co-founders of Anthropic, which is another one of these creators of chatbot like ChatGPT, called Claude. I'm sure I'll get corrected in the comment section of this video. And Clara Shi, the head of Salesforce, the CEO of Salesforce AI. And the one thing that I haven't seen from any AI company in this kind of space or otherwise is any kind of philanthropic vision about what they advocate humans doing with the spare time that their software is going to create. And I think that's a real problem because they're building these machines, and it was even said in this conversation with this co-founder, they have whole teams dedicated to understanding how large language models work. So they don't even understand how large language models work themselves, and they're creating platforms that rely on them to make humans' lives easier. And sure, like all these, ChatGPT, et cetera, is going to make humans' lives easier, and it's going to free up times. And, you know, we are going to get into a place where you would usually have had human operators do things that AI is going to do for us. It's going to free up humans' time. It's probably going to make humans' jobs obsolete, right? In the next 10 years, like that's probably gonna happen in some spaces, but I don't see any kind of philanthropy from those companies about this is what humans should be doing, or this is what we advocate for, where humans can make a difference in the world. Do you agree that they should have this kind of vision, or they should be thinking about these things? Because it's kind of looking to me like they didn't know what they were creating, and they created this behemoth, and now the genie's out of the bottle, so to speak, and here we are.
I think you should take the big picture into consideration from the start, right? And I appreciate the companies, and I don't know about the company that you work for, the company that I work for, we have 5 paid volunteer days off, right? And so, you know, whether it's lessened the work that we have to do or not. I mean, you know, that's just an important part of who our company is and our company culture. And I know Salesforce has similar, you know, things to do. So yes, but I think some of that is important. And that's the reason nonprofits can't be quiet, right? We need to speak up. And one of the reasons that I was so excited to be a Salesforce MVP, because no one has ever accused me of being quiet. And so I like to be loud.
You're not quiet. I can attest to that.
I like to be loud on behalf of nonprofits, right? So I ask that question often. I ask there's so many dreaming events, right? And of course, I co-founded Nonprofit Dreaming with Akash Mishra and for nonprofits specifically, but not everybody could come to Nonprofit Dreaming. So Dreaming event group, I said, who has nonprofit tracks? You know, because you have like developer tracks, administrator tracks, do you have a nonprofit track? Because if you do, I would love to help you find folks willing to present, you know, help you get the word out to the nonprofit community. Because I just think that's super important. One of the things I have preached on AI is, you know, if you are, a woman or a person of color or anything that's diverse, you know, rather than just an old white guy, right? Get on AI and do stuff. I noticed Stacey Whitaker this morning posted on Twitter that she had AI help her write something and it didn't give you a choice of skin tones on the emojis, right? You have to tell it, you know, so does AI think that everybody is the same skin tone? I mean, it probably does unless somebody's taught it differently, right? So I think it's going to be incumbent upon all of us. It's like a child, right? A child needs a village to raise it right. And AI is kind of like that child, and we each need to be a part of its village to make sure that it's doing what it should, and not just the people that are creating the chatbots and the different parts of it.
Oh, that's very, very thought-provoking thing to end on.
Your new child, AI.
Your new child is AI. Okay. Interesting. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation, and the listeners have too. One final question, maybe a short one. You can give me a couple of answers if you want. You mentioned earlier in the podcast that you read a lot and you're an avid reader. One book recommendation, either based on this conversation or just for fun, for the listeners.
Sure. So if you haven't read Vala Afshar's Boundless, read Boundless. It is, and I'm not much of a reader as far as nonfiction goes, but it was a wonderful read and encouraging and fantastic. If you don't follow him, you should. I want to be him when I grow up. But for fun, I read all the British murder mysteries. So Vera and all of the Anne Cleves books and Boundless is probably still my favorite right now. Of course, I haven't finished Practical Artificial Intelligence, so I'll let you know if that's my next favorite.
Excellent. Cool. I will put a link to Boundless in the description of this episode. Melissa Ildiz, thank you so much. And listeners, you've enjoyed this conversation. If you have, like and subscribe on whatever channel you are on. It really helps me out. Continue to bring you great guests like Melissa Ildiz onto the DevOps Diaries podcast. And I will catch you again another time.